Okay. Good. So now let me start the we'll start with the Satipatthana Sutta here, which is pretty much where we left off yesterday at the beginning of the Satipatthana Sutta. And as I said, I will look at this sutta in a comparative perspective, compare it to suttas, same sutta in other traditions in the Chinese and in Sanskrit, etc. So we get a comparative view of this sutta, and that changes the whole sutta quite dramatically once you do that. The certain aspects which go out and certain aspects which are more fundamental, if you like, to this particular sutta. And of course, those things that are in common across the tradition, which are more fundamental, those are the ones that are more important and more worthwhile focusing on here. So this is why we look at this in this way here. So let us just start from the beginning and then gradually go through this, and I will point out as we go through this what those aspects are, and then hopefully get some clarity that way. So this is how it goes. Thus have I heard, on one occasion the Blessed One was living in the Kuru country, where there was a town of the Kurus called Kamasadama. There he addressed the bhikkhus thus, "Bhikkhus, venerable sir," they replied, "the Blessed One said this, bhikkhus, this is the direct path for the purification of beings, for the surmounting of sorrow and lamentation, for the disappearance of pain and grief, for the attainment of the true way, for the realization of Nibbana, namely the four focuses of mindfulness. What are the four? Here, bhikkhus, a bhikkhu abides contemplating an aspect of the body, energetic, fully aware and mindful, having abandoned desire and aversion in regard to the sensory world. He abides contemplating certain aspects of feelings, energetic, clearly comprehending and mindful, having abandoned desire and aversion for the sensory world. He abides contemplating certain mind states, energetic, clearly comprehending, mindful, having abandoned desire and aversion for the sensory world. And he abides contemplating principles or laws of nature, laws of causality, energetic, clearly comprehending and mindful, having put away desire and aversion for the sensory world. So that is the introduction to that sutta. And maybe of some interest is the fact that according to the Pali tradition, this sutta was spoken twice. And there's one version of the sutta in the Digha Nikaya, one in the Majjhima Nikaya. But the versions are actually exactly the same. And the only difference is that the one in the Digha Nikaya is longer and there's added material to it. But apart from the added material, it's exactly the same sutta, given in exactly the same place, right? And this place, Kamasadama, is a little bit, it's not one of the central places in the suttas, and not like Savati or Rajagaha or anything like that. And that leads you to wonder whether it is a duplication of the same sutta that occurs twice, that has been expanded so that it can then be included in the Digha Nikaya as one of the long discourses. And as far as I know, there is no evidence that the sutta occurs twice in any of the other traditions. It seems to be peculiar to the Pali tradition. So I think there is good reasons for thinking that this sutta has been duplicated, because it was considered very important at some stage in the Pali tradition, and therefore it occurs twice. And this is interesting, this idea that the Satipatthana Sutta is considered so important, right? Very often you will hear things like, this is the most important sutta in the Nikayas. But then you have to ask yourself, well, why do people say this? Is there any evidence for this? Or is it just some kind of idea that has arisen over the centuries that this is very important? And there isn't really any evidence as far as the sutta is concerned. The Buddha doesn't say anywhere, you should focus on this, this is the most important one. It is not less important, it is not more important, it is just one sutta among many, and a part of the path of practice. And I don't think you can really say that one sutta is more important than the other ones. It is just part of a parcel, and you have to look at everything together. Everything together, that is the Dhamma, and not any individual suttas as such. So that is my anyway. This is my view of that. And then we have this starting point here, because this is the direct path for the purification of beings. This word direct path, ekayana, often much discussed term, what this actually means, ekayana. Eka means one, ayana usually means like leading or going. So going, one going, or going to one, or something like that. And some people have suggested it means going to samadhi, going to stillness, because eka is a term which is often found in conjunction with samadhi. You have the ekagata, eka plus agata, one-pointedness. Or you have ekodibhuta, which is the mind in the second jhana. Or you have ekatta, which means oneness. And all of these terms are based on the word one, and they all refer to samadhi, to the stillness of the mind. So going to samadhi is one possible meaning, but probably it just means ekayana. It is found in one other sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya, and there it seems to mean which goes in one direction. So the path which goes in one direction only, right? It heads towards nibbana, to the purification of being, and all these things. And that's what I think probably is the most likely interpretation, the path that goes in one direction only for the purification of beings. So purification of beings, I think, is fairly clear. Purifying of defilements, the surmounting of sorrow and lamentation, the disappearance of pain and grief, for the ending of dukkha, for the attainment of the true way. True way is the nyaya in the Pali. It is usually described as the understanding or the penetration of dependent origination in the suttas. So in other words, it is for the understanding of the Buddhist doctrine, the core aspects of the Buddhist doctrine, is what it really means. And this happens at stream entry. When you become a stream entry, that's when you realize these things. And finally, for the realization of extinguishment, the realization of nibbana, which of course happens when you become an arahant. What does it mean to realize nibbana? People often ask this question: what does it mean to realize extinguishment? And what it means, it just means the ending of the defilements. This is how it is defined in the suttas in many places. It just means that you realize the ending of defilements. That's all it really means in the suttas. So it's actually quite simple. It doesn't mean some kind of mystical thing or anything like that. Obviously, it is quite mystical, because people don't normally realize the ending of the defilements, but it is a fairly straightforward understanding of this particular word. And this path is the four focuses of mindfulness. Now, this particular opening here is similar in most of the different versions of the Satipatthana Sutta, so it is probably part of the core aspect of Satipatthana for that reason. Okay, so the next passage I will not look at, because that is the same that we looked at yesterday. And now we will move on to some of the specific contemplations that we're supposed to do according to the Satipatthana Sutta. And what you will see, if you have a quick look at this, is that I have only included two particular contemplations. One of them is the contemplation of the 31 parts of the body, and the other one is the contemplation of the four elements. Now, if you know the Satipatthana Sutta, you will know that the contemplation of the body, the Kaya Nupassana section, actually includes much, much more than that in the Pali. In the Pali, it starts off with the Anapanasati. You have the four postures. You have the clear comprehension of the sati in daily activities. You have the also the cemetery contemplations. And all of this is part of the Satipatthana Sutta in the Pali tradition. And the reason why I have picked out these particular two is because these are core aspects of Satipatthana that you find everywhere across the board in all traditions of the sutta. And especially the 31 parts of the body is the one you find absolutely everywhere. So this is probably the most fundamental one of all. And the four elements contemplation is missing in one or two versions. But apart from that, it is also found universally. And beyond that, it is probably the cemetery contemplations, which is the third most important one. And what you see when you see that is that the whole focus of the Kaya Nupassana, when you look comparative-wise, is a focus on the body itself, understanding the body in terms of giving up attachment and craving and desire for the body. This is the core focus of Satipatthana looked at in a comparative perspective. And you might wonder, what about Anapanasati? Anapanasati is part of the Kaya Nupassana in the Pali version. Why is that? Why doesn't that exist across the board? And I think the reason for that, when we come later on to the Anapanasati Sutta, you can see that Anapanasati is not just about Kaya Nupassana. Anapanasati fulfills all the four Satipatthanas. So for that reason, it is slightly artificial to have it just under Kaya Nupassana, just under body contemplation. It actually belongs with all the four Satipatthanas. So it kind of makes sense that that shouldn't be in there, and rather that is actually instead comes under the Anapanasati Sutta itself. Now, one of the other interesting things here, which is quite obviously comes out of this, is that the idea of being aware, having awareness, having mindfulness of the four postures or all the daily activities is not a core aspect of the Satipatthana Sutta, right? Now that is actually very interesting, because a lot of the sort of modern Vipassana movement meditation is about having mindfulness in daily activities. But as it turns out, this may not be a core aspect of the Satipatthana Sutta. And this is interesting. For me, it always, this kind of mindfulness idea that you are mindful, try to be mindful of everything you do in daily activities, it is actually very difficult to do that, because you have to get things done, you have to do things in life, and that this should not be part of mindfulness, is part of the meditation rather than part of daily activities. It makes fairly good sense to me, because mindfulness is a very, very refined state of mind. Right, it's a very high state of mind. It is virtually impossible to be fully mindful in daily activities. So the way the suttas work, rather, is that we should be clearly comprehending about daily activities. We should have sampajanya. And we have seen this before. This is certainly part of the monastic training, to have sampajanya. In other words, you have clear comprehension of whether the things you are doing lead you in the right direction, whether they are part of the path. You know whether you're practicing your sila, right? You are aware of your actions, you are aware of your speech, and ideally you're also aware to a reasonable extent what is going on in your mind, so you can guide your mind in accordance with the Noble Eightfold Path. So this is quite a radical conclusion, and I think it changes a little bit how we look upon life and what is important in ordinary life. It's not so much about just being mindful. Mindfulness in itself doesn't do all that much. It is about being clearly comprehending, so we can keep on purifying the sila, purifying ourselves. And then, if your sila is pure, then whenever you come to a retreat or you have time for some meditation practice, then because the defilements are low, mindfulness will come fairly naturally as a consequence. But just being mindful, continuously mindful in daily life, does not necessarily help you to be more mindful when you go on retreat. It is the sila which is really the cause for mindfulness. So there you are. So that's pretty radical. And I don't mean to kind of upset anybody by saying these things. I'm just saying these things because this is how it seems to me that this has to be understood. And by the way, when I talk about these things, I base myself in a large part on the studies by a German monk called Venerable Analayo, who is probably the world's foremost scholar in comparative studies. He's one of these language geniuses. He reads Chinese, he reads Tibetan, Sanskrit, Pali, German, English, Russian, French, Italian, and much more. So he's very, very good with languages. And he is the one who does a large part of these comparative studies. And he publishes it in academic journals around the world, Buddhist academic journals. So it comes from him, and it also comes from my close monastic friend, Ajahn Sujato, who has written a whole book called The History of Mindfulness, which is very interesting. It is not for the faint-hearted to read that book. I have to warn you, it's pretty tough going. But for those who are very interested in this particular field and who have a very good grasp of the suttas, it is a worthwhile book to read. History of Mindfulness is available online for free, so you can just search for that and you will be able to find it. History of Mindfulness, Ajahn Sujato, Bhante Sujato. Okay, so now let us, with that introduction in mind, let us have a quick look at these exercises or these particular contemplations of the body. So this is the first one. This is a very famous and well-known contemplation in the suttas, often called the Asubha Bhavana, Asubha practice. Actually, it's not that famous. It's famous in the Satipatthana Sutta and occurs in a few other places, but it's not a very prevalent practice in the suttas. But this is how it goes. Again, bhikkhus. Bhikkhu reviews this same body up from the soles of the feet and down from the top of the hair, bounded by skin, as full of many kinds of impurity. Thus, in this body there are head hairs, body hairs, nails, teeth, skin, flesh, sinews, bones, bone marrow, kidneys, heart, liver, diaphragm, spleen, lungs, intestines, mesentery, contents, actually it should just be stomach, feces, bile, phlegm, pus, blood, sweat, fat, tears, grease, spittle, snot, oil of the joints, and urine. Just as though there were a bag with an opening at both ends, full of many sorts of grain, such as hill rice, red rice, beans, peas, millet, and white rice, and a man with good eyes were to open it and review it thus: this is hill rice, this is red rice, these are beans, these are peas, this is millet, this is white rice. So too, the bhikkhu reviews this same body, up from the soles of the feet and down from the top of the hair, bounded by skin, as full of many kinds of impurity. Thus, in this body there are head hairs, body hairs, nails, teeth, skin, flesh, sinew, bones, bone marrow, kidney, heart, liver, diaphragm, spleen, lungs, intestines, mesentery, stomach, feces, phlegm, pus, blood, sweat, fat, tears, grease, spittle, snot, oil of the joints, and urine. So, there you are. This is often called the Asubha Bhavana. Asubha, literally, Subha means like beautiful. And Asubha then can either mean the non-beautiful or simply the lack of beauty. So, the idea here is to see the body in such a way that it doesn't really become attractive anymore. This is the point of this kind of exercise, this kind of contemplation. But one of the things I think which is interesting about this is that it is here placed in the Satipatthana Sutta, part of Satipatthana, and because it is part of right mindfulness, it's actually a fairly high stage of the path, right? It comes really towards the very end as you're readying yourself to enter Samadhi. So it is about giving that last little push, in a sense, for not having attraction or attachment to the body. This is what this is all about, right? Removing the final attraction to the body, and then by being able to let go of the body, which obviously including the five senses, this is the main obstacle for entering Samadhi, and that is why it becomes so important at this particular point. When you look at this list, first of all, it says this same body, Ayang Eva Kayo, Ayang then refers to this, it refers to one's own body. Remember I was saying yesterday, we focus on ourselves is always the most kind of fundamental thing. And then starting with oneself, once that is established, then one can move on to other beings and other humans. So this very body is what it refers to, starting with yourself. And you are reviewing this, right, or contemplating this, from the soles of the feet down from the top of the hair. So the whole body, every aspect of it, bounded by skin. And it seems here that the idea is to do this in a fairly systematic way. That's why it says, from the soles of the feet and down from the top of the head. You go through the whole body to make sure you haven't forgotten anything here. That there may be one little thing that you think is beautiful and you kind of attach to that perhaps. But the whole body becomes seen in the same light. And impurity, asuchi, that's what it means. Impurity, suchi means pure, like in pure conduct, for example. And the idea here is to see the other aspect of the body. Most of the things on this list are not things you like to identify with, right? You don't think of yourself as pus or blood or sweat. That's not really who you are. You are something else. You are the thing you see in the mirror in the morning. And sometimes it looks quite beautiful, sometimes not so beautiful. And you're very, very happy with that. That is what you like to see. These things are not the kind of things we are tend to be proud of, right? This is my spleen. It looks like this. And so this is the point. We want to neutralize attraction to the body. And this is the point of doing this. So the point is not so much to be repelled by the body, to think the body is terrible. The point is more to neutralize the attraction and get a neutral and a kind of even state of mind. That is the purpose of this. And you can see this if you look at the simile that comes here. That simile makes it fairly clear that it is about a neutral state of mind. It is just as if you are looking into a bag and you see the various kinds of content in this bag, right? So you see the beans, you see this, you see that. Basically, it's a neutral observation of what is present. It's not an observation of something which is repulsive. And of course, that is the body. The body just does its functions, right? These are all the functions of the body. They're not necessarily repulsive. They're just not the sort of things we normally like to attach to. So that is the purpose of this. How does one do this kind of practice? It is actually fairly straightforward. You just do it as basically as it says here. You look inside of yourself, right? You're sitting here. And you can almost like, okay, so this is the brain in here, right? The skull is here. You kind of see your own skull. You can imagine what your skull looks like. It looks like any skull you see outside. It is right here. The skeleton is always with you, right? So you can actually feel the skeleton inside of you. You can feel like one of these skeletons you see hanging on the wall. This is right here. You can feel that. You can't really feel it as a feeling, but you can kind of sort of see it inside of yourself. And then you can kind of go through and you can see all the various parts. You know, you have the lungs, you have the heart, you have the liver, you have the stomach, you have the intestines. And you can kind of see all of these parts being inside of you as you go through. And I think that is really all that's to it, is to feel or to be aware that this actually is the real nature of your body. The body is not just what you see on the outside. It is all the inside stuff is obviously much more of what the body is like. Take the skin off the body and the body is not very beautiful anymore. The skin is kind of what holds it all together and makes it look nice. So that is how I would do this exercise. There may be other ways of doing this. But again, it is a focus on yourself that it really is about. Okay, so remember also that this is not the only thing that helps you to overcome desire in this world, kama, chanda, and raga, and desire for the body. It is the whole Eightfold Path, when practiced rightly, which helps you overcome these things, right? The sense restraint, the clear comprehension, just the ordinary virtues, all of these things are part of overcoming the desires for the body, and all of these things have to be done in the right way. This can help you a little bit, but it is interesting that it occurs right here with sammasati, which is a fairly high, fairly advanced stage on the path of meditation practice. Okay, then we come to this little paragraph which is labeled insight, right? And this paragraph is about how the meditation actually progresses. Now, the first thing I want to point out with this, you see the word insight there, it is in brackets. So why is it in brackets? And the reason it is in brackets is because there is no such word in the Pali. You read the Pali, there's no word saying insight, right? So it has been bracketed to kind of guide you. So these words are supposed to guide you. Now, it is very useful as a guide if it is correct, but if it is incorrect, it becomes very bad, right? It becomes like a distortion of the teachings. It can lead you in the wrong direction. So it is assuming that the translator knows what he's doing. If the translator doesn't know what he's doing, then of course this might be misleading here. And this is what I say in this case. It is actually quite misleading to have the title insight there. It doesn't actually reflect what is going on. I will have a look at this in a second to show you why that is the case. It can be insight, but it can also be samatha. It can be anything, depending on how you do this practice. So these things are little things to be aware of. Sometimes the editors, even of the Pali text, this is something to be aware of if you're really interested in the Pali text. Sometimes the editors of the Pali text will put in little headings, just as they do in the English, right? And what happens is that the heading, which the editor has inserted, of course, in good faith, right? They think that they're doing a service to everybody by pointing out certain things. I'm not suggesting this is done in bad faith, of course. It's done in good faith, trying to help people out. But once the heading gets in there, then after a while, everybody starts to think this is part of the text, and it becomes part of the text itself. And then people think this is the word of the Buddha. And this is how texts change over time, and things get added, and things get changed, and things slowly tend to get distorted. And this is one of the reasons why it is very useful to have comparative studies. Look at suttas from different traditions, because then you can go back to the basic that all the suttas have in common, and you can focus on the core aspects of these teachings, rather than be distracted by things that may have been added over the centuries and over the millennia. It's important to understand that this actually happens with these texts. We can see this in the present day and age, that these things are happening here. Another example for that is in many versions of the Satipatthana Suttas. There's, as I said, there's two versions. There's one is Majjhima Nikaya 10. The other one is Digha Nikaya 22. And one is called the Mahasatipatthana Sutta because it is much longer. The other one is just called the Satipatthana Sutta. But in some versions of the text, both the Majjhima Nikaya and the Digha Nikaya are called the Mahasatipatthana Sutta. So what has happened there is that the sutta in the Digha Nikaya has been moved into the Majjhima Nikaya. Why? Because, well, this one is more complete, right? It has more aspects to it. We want to give everybody a chance to see all the aspects. So we put the long one also into the Majjhima Nikaya. And this is how, again, how things slowly, slowly get expanded, how they get longer, and how things tend to, get over time, things change. And this is just the reality. It's anicca. What do you expect? Of course it has to change. So our point should then try to be to understand that, of course, things change. Let us look at this in an analytical way to try to find the core teachings. Okay, so let us have a look at this paragraph, which is here labeled with insight, and see what it says. In this way, he abides contemplating an aspect of the body internally, or he abides contemplating an aspect of the body externally, or he abides contemplating an aspect of the body both internally and externally. Or else he abides contemplating in the body its nature of arising, or he abides contemplating in the body its nature of vanishing, or he abides contemplating in the body its nature of both arising and vanishing. Or else mindfulness that there is body is simply established in him to the extent necessary for bare knowledge and mindfulness. And he abides independent, not clinging to anything in the world. That too is how a bhikkhu abides contemplating an aspect of the body. So here, what we have here is we have basically three different sections in this little paragraph. The first one is contemplating internally, externally, and internally and externally. Then you have the one about arising, vanishing, and arising and vanishing. And then you have the last one, which is just about having knowledge and mindfulness and abiding independent, not clinging to anything in the world. So there's three aspects to this. And again, if you do the comparative research, you look at what the different suttas have, what you find is that the first part, internally, externally, and internally, externally, that is the one which is common to all the versions of the suttas. And that is likely to be the more essential, the core aspect of Satipatthana practice. That is again very interesting. The aspect about arising, vanishing, and arising and vanishing is the least common one, and the last part is found in most versions. So the part which is used to say that Satipatthana essentially is called a vipassana practice, which is the arising and vanishing, that actually is not found in that many versions of the Satipatthana Sutta, mostly found in the Pali version. So this again, it shifts our understanding of what Satipatthana is all about, and the focus, our focus shifts. So what does internally, externally, and internally, externally means? What does this mean? And it means that, of course, internally is ajjatang. It literally means regarding oneself. Ajjata, addi, atta, relating to oneself. So that's what I was saying before. You relate it to your own body. You look at yourself in terms of these 31 parts. Ajjatang then most naturally concerns the bodies of others. Right? There was a question about this yesterday, whether it means seeing your own body from the inside or from the outside. I think what it really means is looking at yourself and then looking bahidda means at other people. And that is supported by certain other texts in the suttas which talk about using these contemplations in this way. So first you look at yourself, get that sorted out. Then you look at the bodies of others. And then finally, you look at both yourself and others. And that is where you universalize, right? All bodies are the same. Everything is the same, whether it's mine or that of others. Whether it's this rebirth or another rebirth. Whether it's this realm or another realm. All of these bodies are constituted in the same way. There is no escape from this. This is the way it always has to be. So it becomes then a universal understanding where they understand there is no exception to this particular rule. And this particular internal, external, and then internal, external contemplation, it is related elsewhere in the suttas. In the sutta in the Digha Nikaya called the Janasabha Sutta, and that sutta, it shows that this relates directly to samadhi practice. You do this practice, and then you attain samadhi as a consequence. So the question then arises, well, if that is the case, if you attain samadhi as a consequence, if it is correct that perhaps this vanishing, arising, and vanishing, arising is not such a core aspect of Satipatthana, what kind of practice is this? This practice of watching or contemplating the 31 parts of the body. Is it samatha? Is it vipassana? What kind of practice is it? And some people will say it's vipassana because you're looking at the body and you're trying to see the true nature of the body. Instead of seeing it as a subha, you're seeing it as asubha, without beauty. Right? So they would say because of that, it has to do with vipassana practice, to see things clearly. Other people will say, well, this is all about abandoning raga, abandoning craving, right? So because it's about abandoning craving, it is about samatha practice, about calming down the mind. But what I would say is that it is both samatha and vipassana. Because if you are, the purpose of this very clearly is to abandon craving, abandoning raga, abandoning defilements. And as a consequence of abandoning defilements, two things happen, samatha and vipassana. So it is about both. Just like every aspect of the Noble Eightfold Path, from the beginning to the end, is about both aspects. As you reduce the defilements, samatha and vipassana both come into existence, and you see things more clearly here. So again, it's this idea that somehow we can divide some exercises are vipassana, some things are samatha. It just doesn't make any sense because everything we do is about reducing defilements, and everything must lead to both samatha and vipassana. Okay, so that is that one, the first exercise, and then we have the last aspect of this little standard ending here. And this is about or else he is mindful that there is body is simply established in him to the extent necessary for bare knowledge and mindfulness. Bare knowledge and mindfulness, this is the word bare, it is matta. Matta in Pali, matta doesn't really mean bare, it means like a certain amount, right? A degree of. So a degree of knowledge and a degree of mindfulness. In other words, not the full knowledge, not the highest mindfulness, but enough for this particular practice. And I think the point of this is that when the defilement subsides, then what remains is the bare knowledge sufficient knowledge of that there is body. The distortion is gone. And what you're seeing now, you're seeing the body in more neutral terms because the raga, the desire, has declined or disappeared in regard to the body. So now the knowledge and the true nature of things, you see that much more simply. So it's simply established there is body. No desire is involved anymore. And that is why you abide independent, right? Anicito, independent. You're not dependent on the body. There's no raga desire there. So you are independent of that. When you have craving for something, you are like dependent on it. Your mind is leaning on it. In this case, your mind is no longer leaning on this. It stands apart from the body. And you're not clinging to anything in the world. You're not clinging to that body specifically. That is what this is about in this particular case. So this second part here is more like the result of this practice. And the first part here is more about how you do it. So you can see two aspects of the kaya nupassana, the contemplation of the body here. Okay, so that is the first part here, the contemplation of the body. So I will then move on to the second one, which is the contemplation of the four elements. So similar kind of thing. It's about abandoning the attraction to the body by understanding the body in terms of the natural elements of which it is constituted. And this is how this goes. Again, bhikkhus, a bhikkhu reviews this same body, however it is placed, however it disposed, by way of elements thus. In this body, there are the earth element, the water element, the fire element, and the air element. Just as though a skilled butcher or his apprentice had killed a cow and was seated at the crossroad with it cut up into pieces, so too a bhikkhu reviews this same body, however it is placed, however it is disposed, by way of elements thus. In this body, there are the earth element, the water element, the fire element, and the air element. And then the same kind of refrain, if you like, at the end here. In this way, hereby is contemplating an aspect of the body internally, and then externally, and internally, and externally. And then, or else, mindfulness that there is body is simply established in him to the extent necessary for a degree of knowledge and mindfulness, and he abides independent, not clinging to anything in the world. This too is how a bhikkhu abides contemplating an aspect of the body. So here we have the four elements. It's just a traditional way of regarding physical matter. Physical matter comes in terms of the earth, right, the hard aspects of things, the water, which is like the fluid aspect of things, the air, and then heat or coldness, which is here called the fire element. And so the body, this is what the body is. That's all it is. It is these four elements. And if you look at the Mahahatipadobhama Sutta, it gives a long exposition on how to regard these four elements and how to relate the body to the other elements of the world. And what this Mahahatipadobhama Sutta, the point it makes is that just as the elements in this body, just so the elements outside. There is no distinction. The elements in this body are just like the natural elements outside. And where has this body arisen from? It has arisen from the external elements, right? I think it says in the suttas, in a kind of, this is the Pali idiom, you know, this body is built up of rice and porridge, or something like that. You know, so you eat rice and porridge, this is probably what they ate mostly in India in those days. And then this body comes into existence from that. So it comes from the external elements, and it gets built up. And then when you die, when you get buried, or you get burnt, or whatever, then this body again goes back to those same elements. So this body is just a temporary coming together of these elements in this particular form. And then it goes out again. It arises out of the ordinary elements and disappears back into the elements. It's exactly the same as the external elements. Just comes into this form and then disappears again. So this is what this is about. So very anicca, very impermanent, very unreliable, just changing all the time. And of course, through life, the body is changing continuously as a consequence of the impermanent nature of things. So that is really how you contemplate this. And then, of course, how can you hold on to this? How can you hold on to these elements that just belong to nature, don't really belong to you, and they form together into a certain way according to natural laws, and then dissolve again later on? There's nothing there to hold on to. Just this process moving along of nature, of material phenomena coming together in certain ways and then disappearing again. There's nothing to hold on to. It's like there's no ground there. You know, it's like the carpet, the rug being pulled out under your feet when you're trying to hold on to something which actually is impermanent. And this is one of the things about understanding anicca, understanding impermanence. You start to understand that wherever you grasp, wherever you attach to anything, wherever you try to hold on, there's nothing there to hold on to. The rug is always continuously being pulled out under your feet. And you're always kind of trying to find a balance on nothing. There's nothing there to balance on. And this is the problem with attachment. So this is another nice little contemplation. And again, it takes away a lot of this desire for the body, this attachment to the body. There's nothing there to really to hold on to. And when you do that again, of course, the mind is leaning towards samadhi, because this is one of the biggest obstacles to samadhi, attachment to the body, attachment to the senses. Senses and body are very closely related to each other, so you're also here giving up a lot of the sensory indulgence at the same time. It goes together here. So, that's it. And then, of course, again, internally, right? Your own body, externally, the body of others. And then you universalize. All bodies have this nature. There is no body that is apart from this. You're not going to find some body which is different. This problem would always be there, regardless of what you do, where you get reborn, or what happens to you. Okay, so that is the contemplation of the body. I left out the cemetery contemplations because they are, they are also there, and they are fairly common, as I said, across the different versions of the suttas, but not as common as the first two ones. So I left those out, and they go on for quite a long time. So I thought I might leave those out. So having done that, we can have a quick look at the contemplation of feelings. That the body contemplation, the core part of body contemplation is finished. And for the contemplation of feelings, this is a little bit different from the body contemplation. In the body contemplation, there are only a few of the contemplations that are core to all the traditions. With the feeling contemplation, actually, it is almost exactly the same in all the different traditions of this sutta. So here we can just use the Pali, and that will be should be a very reliable guide as to what is the original nature of this particular sutta. So, and this is how it goes. And how, bhikkhus, does the bhikkhu abide contemplating an aspect of feelings? Here, when feeling a pleasant feeling, a bhikkhu understands, I feel a pleasant feeling here. When feeling a painful feeling, he understands, I feel a painful feeling here. When feeling a neither painful nor pleasant feeling, he understands, I feel a neither painful nor pleasant feeling here. When feeling a worldly feeling, he understands, I feel a worldly feeling here. When feeling an unworldly feeling, unworldly pleasant feeling, he understands, I feel an unworldly pleasant feeling here. When feeling a worldly painful feeling here, he understands, I feel a worldly painful feeling here. When feeling an unworldly painful feeling, he understands, I feel an unworldly painful feeling here. When feeling a worldly, neither painful nor pleasant feeling, he understands, I feel a worldly, neither painful nor pleasant feeling here. And when feeling an unworldly, neither painful nor pleasant feeling here, he understands, I feel an unworldly, neither painful nor pleasant feeling here. So this is the contemplation of feelings. And a large part of this is just to understand the feelings, right? To understand what the feelings are. And the most basic thing is to be able to distinguish between pleasant feeling, painful feeling and neither painful nor pleasant feelings, and to understand those fully, which category they belong to. And once you understand what categories they belong to, you can understand their impermanence, or perhaps permanence, right? You don't know beforehand, but presumably their impermanence, because you can see them changing. If you have a full understanding, you can know when all pleasant feelings have ceased, and there's only painful feeling behind it. So then you can understand the impermanence of these things. And an important distinction that is made in the sutta is the distinction between what is here called worldly feelings and unworldly feelings. And the worldly feelings are the feelings that relate to the five senses, that relate to the kamavachara. Kamavachara is the kama loka, the world of the five senses. That is the worldly feelings. And the unworldly feelings here are the, and it's called the samisa feelings. And then the niramisa feelings are the unworldly feelings, the spiritual feelings, if you like. Niramisa, the things that arise and are above the ordinary world of the five senses. These are the niramisa. Literally, amisa means something like flesh. So this means like beyond the flesh or without flesh kind of feelings. So spiritual feelings. And these are the feelings that we start to feel in meditation, right? When you get some joy while you're doing satipatthana, when you get some joy by doing a kind of an act of kindness or generosity, that joy is an aspect of this niramisa sukha. It is still a little bit mixed, because still you can maybe feel the body a little bit in the background. It's not a pure niramisa sukha. The pure niramisa sukha, unworldly feelings, only happen in deep samadhi. That happens in the jhana states, that sort of thing. But you already start feeling these things as your meditation deepens. So this is one of the most important things here, that distinction between the feelings relating to the five senses and the feelings related to the spiritual aspects of the path. Right? And you can see why. We've been talking about this all along, about how to abandon the defilements, right? So you understand the feelings that have to do with defilements, that relate to karma, relate to craving, all these things. And then you understand the feelings that do not relate to karma, do not relate to tanha and craving. And when you understand the difference between these things, then you can start to understand which way you want to lean. You want to lean towards the feelings that do not have anything to do with craving, precisely because they are more beautiful, they are more pleasant. There's no agitation there. There's no restlessness with those feelings because the craving is gone. And you start to see where you're supposed to be heading. Not only do you see that, but you also see that this niramisa sukha has many different levels. So you start getting your samadhi together and you start to see the niramisa sukha just increasing and increasing and increasing. And you can sort of see it is heading in a direction which is quite amazing. And sometimes you wonder how much happiness you can feel, right? It just goes on and on in that direction. And of course, then you understand the kind of sublime nature of these feelings, because they can go so high. Whereas with the sensual pleasures, it is much, much more limited. So this is why you contemplate these things, and by understanding these things, that is what enables you, in part, to abandon the worldly feelings and then move on to the spiritual unworldly feelings instead. One of the interesting feelings here, which you perhaps, I don't know if you noticed that while we're reading through this, is a kind of a strange feeling, right? It is the, what is it called? It is in there, the unworldly painful feeling, right? So this is the spiritual painful feeling. What is that? We always talk about the spiritual happy feeling. We go into meditation, we feel happiness. So what on earth could the spiritual painful feeling be? And this is defined elsewhere in the suttas. This is in the Udesa Vibhanga Sutta, in the Majjhima Nikaya, 137, I think, something like that. And there it explains the unworldly painful feeling is the feeling that when you understand that all the problems in the world, right, and you get a rise in this desire in your heart, oh, when am I going to find that liberation from all this trouble, to attain Nibbana, just like the other Aryans in the world do now? It is understanding this weariness with the world, seeing the world doesn't add up, doesn't make you happy, And you get this kind of desire, this kind of feeling, I want to get out of this. But you're not yet out of it. You're on the way. You understand a little bit, but not that fully out. And then that kind of, that yearning, not actually being there, is a, there's a slight pain related to it, but it's a kind of pain which leads in the right direction. So that is the unworldly, painful feeling, just in case you wonder what that was all about. Okay, so that is all I'm going to say about feelings. And again, the same kind of principle applies. You contemplate it internally regarding yourself. You contemplate it externally in regard to others. Sometimes the question is, how do you contemplate the feelings of others externally? And in some places it is said that what you do is you contemplate it using psychic powers, and you actually see the feelings in others. That must be very few people who in that case can actually do this kind of contemplation. I would think that a more practical way is simply to infer that these feelings also occur in other people, not just you. And sometimes you can probably see that just by observing them, just by looking at them, seeing that sometimes they are in pain, sometimes in happiness. And then again, finally, in the end, you universalize internally and externally is the same. All beings have to experience these kind of feelings. It doesn't matter where you go in this, where you travel in this round of rebirth, this samsara, you are bound to experience these kind of feelings. There is no way of getting away from this. So in other words, it doesn't help you to get reborn somewhere else. It doesn't help you to go to the Devaloka. It doesn't help you. There is no freedom from this. Everywhere it is the same. So this is the kind of the understanding that starts to arise in you. Okay, lastly, we will quickly go through also the contemplation of mind. And how, bhikkhus, does a bhikkhu abide contemplating here? Actually, maybe I should leave this out because it's getting a bit late now, and we can do that as part of the next one, I think. Otherwise, we're probably pushing ourselves a little bit, and then we end up doing things too fast. So let's stop there, and then we'll see you again later on this afternoon.